The topic of this conversation is coping with change. And this is something I've been working at this point for almost 4 years, and this is related to international politics, but it can be adapted to a lot of other things. First of all, I want to tell you what I mean by change, and then maybe say something about this trend of change, and then maybe let's talk about the capacity of adaptation, our capacity in our institutions, etc. Change. Why is worth to talk about change? Because there's nothing new in change. The world has been changing throughout centuries. And what I think is particularly interesting of change nowadays is the speed of change. And the speed of change that we're experiencing right now is almost unprecedented in the history of humankind. Now, our capacity to adapt to this change is much slower. Our individual, but also our institutional and our bureaucratic capacity. And what particularly concerns me is this gap between this very fast train that is moving, and I will tell you a little more about what these trends are, and this slow carriage of our capacity to adapt and to respond to this change. So let me say something about this change. The first, let's call them mega trends. So the first mega trends I want to talk about is people. It is demographic, what the expert called demographics. I mean, the first things that you have to realize is the number of people on the planet. Numbers is unprecedented growth. The population is reaching almost 7 billion people. By 2050, will be 9 billion people. At the beginning of the last century, we were only 1.9 billion people on the planet. So there's an explosion of number of people on the planet. Now, it's not only the explosion, but it's also a distribution of these people on the planet. 93% of this growth will be in Africa, will be in Asia, and in Middle East. Just think that in 1950, Europe's population was twice the size of Africa. In 2050, the population of Africa will be three times the population of Europe. Massive change. Now, it's not only the distribution of population, of course, throughout continents, but it's also the distribution through ages that is dramatically changes. We have some countries that's becoming super young, and some countries becoming very old. Japan and Italy are two examples of countries that are aging, with implication, of course, for public health and pension systems and so on and so forth. While you have countries, especially in Africa, but also in Middle East, also places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, where more than 50% of the population is between the age of 15 and 29. And you understand the challenge of providing education, jobs to these people. And then, of course, also disenfranchised youth tend to be easily recruitable by gangs and violent groups, rebels, and in the worst case scenarios, by terrorists. So this is called youth budge, and it's happening throughout the world in a very substantive way. Youth bulge. Some countries that are exploring the mass of people between 15 and 29. And the last trend that I want to talk about in demographic is urbanization. Now, urbanization is becoming the major feature of our times. Since 2008, more than half of the people on the planet live in cities. So we're living in an urbanized city. By 2050, projections say that 64% of the population will be in cities, and so on. This has, of course, implication for how cities are able to cope with this mass of people. I think we can already say that there are cities that are some way failing to provide services to this mass of people. Just think about places like Lagos, think about places like Johannesburg, and so on and so forth. So urbanization, a big trend, that, of course, has implication also on traditionally agricultural societies and a change of culture within certain societies. Technology is the second trend that I want to talk about. There are more than 5 billion mobile telephones, mobile subscribers in the world. 5 billion. That's more mobile subscribers than there are actually people on the planet 20 years ago. There are 9.5 million SMS sent out every minute. That is like entire Manhattan sending out an SMS every minute. There are, I think, I have my little chat here because sometimes I don't remember all this data. But there are more than 2 billion YouTube views per day. I mean, these numbers are incredible. And in fact, they're really influencing also the way politics is perceived. Just think about the recent event of the interception of the Gaza flotilla, the Turkish flotilla that was going to Gaza. It became immediately a YouTube war between the Israeli defense and the Palestinians with their different videos. In Haiti, the international community raised $7 million over SMS in 3 days. So technology is becoming sort of a reality of our time. That, of course, has also implications in how politics and politicians are acting and scrutinized, and basically there is no private conversation anymore, and that's really changing the way we deal with the political environment. Now, technology, yes, is great, is happening everywhere, but just think that 60% of Americans are connected to internet. In Middle East, only 30% of the people. In Africa, 10%. So it's not really true that we're all so technological. There is a huge technological gap. And this brings me to the third mega trend, which is disparities. The world is growing very differently. 20% of the richest people in the world own 75% of the wealth. The bottom 20% owns only 3%. So it's big disequality in the way wealth is distributed. It's not only about, of course, wealth, it's about education. 1.6 people in the world are unable to read and write. 60% of them are women.
1.6 billion?
No, one of six people in the world. One out of six. Roughly 1.2 billion people. And 60% of them are women. So education, major issues. Education means no possibility actually to access services and education and so on and so forth, and jobs. Health. Roughly, in average, a developed country has between 20 to 60 doctors per people. In some developing countries, less than 5. Places like Liberia, Sierra Leone, there's no access to health. That's, of course, create huge problems. And then basic resources like food and water. We still have roughly 1 billion people with not enough to eat. The food crisis of 2008 bumped up these numbers. We're now going a little bit down, but we're still higher than 2008. Water. One of three people in the world suffer from water scarcity. The need of feeding more people on the planet is putting more water into agriculture. Which, of course, is depleting resources. Part of the world, for geographical reasons, like the Middle East and North Africa, is 97% less water resources than the rest of the world. So water is becoming a big issue. From disparities and from resources, let me move into what I think in some ways is sort of a defining trend in the 21st century, which is the search for energy. 84% of our energy resource energy needs are satisfied through oil and gas. This is still a huge number, but what is fascinating in terms of trend is the increase in nuclear and in renewable energy as well. First of all, because we are all developing, we are all consuming more. Since 1990, we consume 45% of more energy. By 2025, we will consume an additional 47% of energy. That means that clearly we have to find a way to satisfy this demand, which is only this, bound to grow, and that's, of course, good. Nuclear energy is becoming a big substitute. Some people talk about renaissance, a new renaissance in nuclear power. Projection are in 20, 25 years, more than 45% of our needs will be satisfied through nuclear power. You do understand the problem of nuclear proliferation, of course. It's on the papers every day on, for example, the Iranian attempt to enrich uranium, and they could potentially develop a weapon if they want. My assessment, if Iran goes nuclear, more other countries in the region want to go nuclear, and maybe other countries in the world. That means basically that our non-proliferation treaty will fall apart, and you know, it's just going to an escalation. More countries with nuclear knowledge and power also increase the risk that criminals and terrorists could acquire their own bomb. So nuclear power is potentially a good source of energy, but has very risky implications. Renewable energy is becoming a major business. But very interestingly, some original countries are working in this area. Turkey, for example. Turkey has been increasing their solar panel capacity tenfold in the last 5 years. The Emirates are building a free carbon city, which will host 50,000 people, basically a living experiment. 50,000 people live in a city with, you know, free carbon. And it's the Emirates, where their economy is 80% based on oil. So it's a very interesting trend there. So energy, I think, another defining trend. All this search for energy is putting a lot of pressure on environment. And this brings me to my fifth trend, which is environmental degradation. Here I'm not going to say much because we all know about climate change. I'm not going what is happening. To some extent, it doesn't really matter to me if you believe that this is driven by man activities or just a natural phenomenon, but it's clearly happening. There's been a massive increase of natural disasters in the last 10 years. There are projections with people displacement within countries will be growing up to 20 million people in the next 20 years. We're clearly not capable of coping with such a massive number of people being displaced. 2010 is again on track to be the hottest year on record. And of course, the other big problem is arable land is decreasing dramatically. Lack of resources can also be a source of conflict, and we see that in Africa. We see in Darfur, and we see in other places. And this brings me to my sixth trend, which is violence and physical insecurity in general. I think we live in a society that is more secure, of course, than in the past. Actually, the number of conflicts has been decreasing, but there are still more than 50 conflicts around the world. Out of three conflicts are in Africa. Some conflicts have regional and global implication. I would make an argument that conflicts in the Middle East are the ones that have the most global implication of all. A war in Lebanon, which is not that unlikely, could triple through and give effects that can be devastating on our economy, energy, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, conflicts like in Chad or in Congo have less global impact. Massive impact on the life of the people there, but of course have less global impact. It's probably one of the ways we have put less attention into these conflicts. Another trend of violence, of course, is terrorism. We're all very aware. There's been 50,000 casualties of terrorism last year. 40% of them are in Iraq. The rest is in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. So there is a strong regional dimension in terrorism as well. Terrorism also is not only a physical problem, of course, has very deep psychological implications for the society and for politics. And finally, just one other additional fact of violence, which is organized crime. This is very fascinating, what is happening to organized crime. Organized crime is taking advantage of our interconnected world in a very effective way. Make just one example. West Africa. As you probably know, West Africa is coming out of a decade of conflict. They have a youth bulge, high level of corruption. It's becoming a hub for trafficking cocaine from Latin America into Europe. So now cocaine is transported into West Africa. West Africa, Guinea-Bissau, Sierra Leone, there's no border security. They land with this Cessna on the beach. They take the drug, they cut the drug in West Africa. That's because it's less, it's more secure. And then they ship it into Europe market. And these networks are also supplying weapons to Afghanistan, for example. So the complexity of these criminal networks is definitely increasing. This brings me to my final mega trends, which I would call it shifting influence and power. And what I mean by that is, and it's hard to quantify. What I mean by that is, okay, if we measure power by military power, the world is pretty much unipolar. United States, $660 billion budget for defense, which is higher than the following 16 countries combined. Now, military power is not the only power. We're living in a world in which other powers are sometimes even more influential. And we've seen it, actually, with this massive military power, we've not been able to fix problems that we wanted to fix, like Iraq and Afghanistan. Economic power is also, of course, shifting very much. Just a couple of data. Last year, the high-level, high-income countries, their GDP decreased by 3.3%. Meanwhile, China increased by 8%, India increased by 7%, Nigeria increased by 5%, and Egypt by 4%. So the gap is decreasing, equilibriums are changing. China, which in 2000 was investing a little less than $1 billion in development around the world, is now investing $27 billion. And it's an increase in the Chinese role around the world, which is really dramatic. I'm not going to tell you anything about how our economies are interconnected, because we all know what globalization is, but we are in a world in which GM is selling more cars to China than the United States. And I think that forces us to rethink what national interest is about. So a traditional way of thinking about national interest is very different nowadays than what it was before. I think culture is also part of influence. I belong to a generation, but we grew up under the American influence. Today, Egyptian pop singers sell more CDs and songs than Americans in that region. Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, they all rival in BBC. They are watched not only in the region, but all by Arab speakers in the United States, for example, so they don't watch, you know, American channels. They have roughly 40 to 50 million viewers in Middle East. Turkey is exporting soap operas in the region. More than 80 million people are watching Turkish soap operas. And Turkey is not an Arab country. So it's also very interesting how they're influencing the Arab culture. I think they're looking at an Islamic democratic country as a sort of a model. And finally, religion. I think we're witnessing another big trend here in religion. Religions are developing unlinked from their cultural roots. I mean, today, Islam is everywhere. It's not necessarily linked to where it was born. This is due to migration, of course, but also due to internet and media. And this mix of religions, I think, in some way, is contradicting what a political scientist in 96, I don't know if you remember his name, was Samuel Huntington's, was calling the clash of civilizations. He split the world in seven groups, and he said, if there's going to be a war, it's going to be over civilizations. I don't think it's true. I think we cannot divide the world by civilizations anymore. Civilizations are mixed. 10% of Europeans today are Muslim people. And they will grow, they will keep growing. This goes well beyond borders. Ultimately, the real tension will be between progressive and conservative views. And this is within borders, not across borders. And of course, this is very destabilizing and create confusion. And I think some people tend to read religions and certain messages in a more conservative way, in a more extremist way, and that can lead, not necessarily, but can also lead to violence. So these are the sort of seven, if you want, kind of mega trends that I see happening. And what I repeat, what is striking is how fast this is happening. I think 5 years ago, we were not able to think that China would be such a major player. If you ask me what is going to happen in 10 years, I literally don't know. But politically, a lot of things are happening. A lot of new clubs. You know, the G20 is now gathering at leader level. The BRIC country, you know, the BRIC, this is something that was invented by an economist in Goldman Sachs, and now is becoming a reality. BRIC stands for Brazil, Russia, India, and China. They actually have their own summit. They call the BRIC summit, which is fascinating. What do these four countries have in common? Very little. But I think they all see that there is a gap there, and something is happening, and they're, you know, filling in. A few months ago, very interesting, Turkey and Brazil, who are sitting in the Security Council of the United Nations, voted against sanction on Iran. So they took a very strong stand, and that's upset the U.S. very much, but there's not much the U.S. could do. They still voted against it. And so these leadership club, how I would call them, I think are a sign of how uncertain the environment is. Countries are just testing alliances, and because it's a very fluid context. And I think if there is one feature at the end of our times is that we need to learn how to cope with change and uncertainty. Some people has also created a myth of the Cold War to the point that there were two points of reference at least. Things were, you know, stable. And a lot of political scientists say that bipolar world, you know, the bipolar world is something we should aim to. But I think they forget what the Cold War was really about. I mean, people was living under the threat of nuclear annihilation. I mean, I think this is a mythology of the Cold War. But, again, it's a sign of uncertainty, of the uncertainty we have now. In the Cold War, at least you have some point of reference. Now it's very hard to say where these point of references are. So that's how I basically see the world. And I, because of my job, I'm in some way focusing on where the problems are. I, of course, do recognize that we live in a world that is way much better than it was 50 years ago. I'm actually a big fan of Karl Popper, who always said that every day we live in the best possible day. And I do agree with that. But the nature of my job is not to congratulate with each other, but is actually to focus on that little other piece of the road that we still have to make. And so I'm just in some way preventing, you know, reaction, because I do recognize that there are less nuclear weapons now than during the Cold War, that child mortality has been decreasing since 1990 by 30%, even HIV/AIDS, new infected, has been decreasing dramatically, more than 26% since 1994. So it's happening. I mean, very good things are happening. Same time, I mean, these seven mega trends are putting a lot of pressure on our institution. And individually, I think. I mean, people, you know, has a hard time to cope with a lot of this change. I guess the last 3 minutes, maybe. Is that okay? Is that some time? I will maybe say something about what to do about it, which is, of course, the hard part. Now, what to do about it gets a little boring because sometimes you get in very technical solutions, especially on how to reform our institutions, and that's can be a little technical and boring. Well, you know, of course there is a capacity to adapt at the individual level, and that is very hard to summarize. People have different level of capacity. I think we see some trends in Europe, for example, where there is a group of Europeans who feel overwhelmed by a change of culture, and they just react in a way that in some way they want to reject and go back to their original roots. the reality of the fact is Europe is changing and is becoming a multicultural society, as probably the US is and has always been. But it's a very different history. And of course, places like Middle East, multicultural society, I mean, even more complex to accept as a principle. I mean, Lebanon, which is a multicultural society, has been at war for decades. But the real problem is, as individuals, when we aggregate into institutions and into bureaucracies, that's the way we know how to address problems together, we become very slow. The way change happens in institutions, in governments, it's a glacial speed. Things has to be compromised, it has to be discussed. People think the United Nations is just a sort of talk shop where people talk, and nothing really happens. And it's quite true. And I work very closely to the United Nations, and I see a lot of people talking all day. I still think it's better talking than killing each other, but still, very little action. We've seen, I mean, the Doha round, the trade agreements, has been stalling for like decades almost. The climate change meetings are completely pointless. A country like Sudan, which is run by someone called Bashir, who is indicted by the International Criminal Court, so in theory should be in jail, has been basically blocking an agreement on climate change. Sudan, which is clearly not the key player on climate change. So I think we do have this problem at the institutional level. That we're not able to cope with the speed of this change. Institutions do change, but they change over time, very slowly. And I think that's what worries me very much. We're losing the capacity to react and to manage. We're just becoming reactive. When something happens, we have a crisis, something happens, we try to go there and fix it. This is extremely expensive, first of all, and also you will notice more and more domestic politics doesn't really accept that anymore. And it's very hard for politicians to make a case, to go in countries, to do things, and don't really understand why. We have domestic problems, why the hell we have to go abroad, and so on and so forth. So you get all these kind of trends there. In sort of a keywords, what I personally think is we do not need new institutions. I think we have plenty of global institutions. The problem is they should be more coordinated. Bureaucracy should be shrinked. They should be merged. Within the UN, there are more than 52 agencies dealing with environment. That's way too much. And someone even proposing to have a new agency on environment to deal with climate change. I don't think we need one. I mean, we do have the tools. Just need to coordinate them and put it in place in a proper way. We also need to learn that being expert of a specific field is a good thing, but it's not enough. I think in politics, in governments, we need people with a broader picture capacity. Things are getting more and more complicated. Having just an Afghanistan expert is not enough to solve the Afghanistan problem. You need someone who understands drug trafficking. You have someone who understands the dynamics between China, India, and Pakistan. You need someone who's able to understand development, education, and so on and so forth. So I would advocate that we need people who have a different approach to the way that things are done. And, frankly, I think the U.S. model is very interesting. In the U.S., they're not only diplomats by career. As you know, there are a lot of diplomats which are politically appointed. That, of course, has certain problems as well. But in a lot of countries, that doesn't happen. It means that the foreign affairs mind is... It's closed. It's just people who've been doing an exam maybe 25 years ago, and they did their little career step by step. There's no external contamination with new ideas. I personally would open up all the foreign services to applications. Everybody should be able to apply, depending on the job, like every other job. Why do you need a state exam when you were 18 or 22? Again, I'm getting to technicalities, and there's many others, but I don't want to be too boring. Last thing, if I were in charge of development, I would put my money in one thing, which is education. When I say education, I'm even more specific. I mean primary education of girls in the top 25 countries, the most underdeveloped countries in the world. I make just one example, which is Bangladesh. Bangladesh in 1960s, only 20% of women were educated. Today, we go up to 60, due to the fact that Bangladesh has been investing 6 to 7% of their GDP into education. Pakistan, by comparison, only 2%. 6 to 7% of GDP, while Pakistan 2% in the last 40 years. Why I'm talking particularly about education of young girls? Because there's a triple effect in a society. First of all, of course, it's the right things to do. But secondly, educated women tend to have less children. That means they were solving the youth bulge problem. You also create less aggravation of women. Educated women tend to take more care of their own health and the health of their own family. And finally, women are also very good in economics. Microcredit, microfinance have been proven to be way more effective when you give $5 to a woman than $5 to a man. So there are many reasons beyond the fact that it's a good thing to do. I wrap up saying, you know, maybe 30 years ago, our foreign policy was in some way driven by values. You know, we were saying, well, we have to do something. You know, if you remember the Biafra anger, you know, problems, you know, we have to do something for these people, you know. I think today is not only values, it's actually interest. Because the world is so interconnected that whatever happened in Islamabad has an effect in London. And we cannot just be value-driven, but it's also an interest-driven policy. And I think that is the sort of a key change that we have to face.
And can I just ask you also to talk about the one trend that we've been speaking about before that you didn't name was this kind of, let's say, cynicism, this lack of trust in institutions, civil society institutions.
I mean, that's also a very interesting thing. I mean, I don't know how you see it, but I think probably worldwide, I mean, let's make a big generalization here, but there is a big growing disconnection between the world of politics and the sort of a so-called civil society. Disillusion in some way with the way politics works. To me, is actually reflected by what I just said. It's by this change going fast and people moving fast, and politics and institution, you know, try to keep up. And people notice that, and they just get disappointed and disillusioned. This is a very dangerous trend, of course, which I think is happening everywhere in the world. And big disconnection between what we call civil society and political figures. You know, nowadays, the real power doesn't necessarily stay with politicians anymore. I mean, as you know, I mean, there are you know, philanthropic people around the world that invest in philanthropy more than what the United States as a country invests. Okay, so individual, like, you know, Bill Gates, he's investing, he's giving more money than what the United States give globally. The example I make is the power of the stars nowadays. I mean, when you do a meeting in the UN about water shortages, you get maybe 100 people in the room. If you bring George Clooney, you get 1,000 people. I'm not kidding. Are they there to see George Clooney? Maybe. But I don't care. They actually stay there. And people like George Clooney, who's highly articulated in what he says, is able to pass a message. And I think this is another sign how politicians are losing ground, and because we live in a world of you know, media and TVs and etc., these are becoming a sort of point of references. So I think there is a big transformation there as well. But, you know, there is a substitution effect. People won't just say, oh, I'm disappointed, I'm not going to do anything. They're going to go somewhere else and satisfy their demand in some other ways. And in some places can be highly destabilizing, of course, because, you know, you don't know where people go, right? For me, I read radicalization and extremism also due to this. Disappointed with leadership, they go to other routes. And certain messages can be very attractive. And people respond to these messages.
And when Kant writes in 1791, violation of rights in one part of the earth is felt all over.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the difference between then and now is the role of technology?
I think technology is, I mean, it is a visionary, because in 1795, you know, I mean, to go from Germany to Indonesia, it was taking like 6 months, right? I mean, absolutely. But I totally agree with that. I mean, again, we can bring it at the level of principles, which is of course always interesting. But I would also bring it back to level of interest, which is ultimately what makes people act. Sometimes, it is truly an interest for us to have a peaceful Middle East, because you know we depend on energy very much in that area. Because what happened in the Middle East, in the Gulf area, has triple effect throughout the economy in the world. And we've seen, I mean, we're witnessing the financial crisis, all of us, and we've seen by the time there was a meeting in Washington to discuss about it, 50 countries were already kind of suffering from domino effect. Again, politics try to keep up with the speed of the change. So I totally agree. It's the interlinkages that makes things even more complicated. Well, any comments, critique, questions?
I have two questions. So one is maybe too economic related, and the second one is general. So the general question is, you mentioned 7th mega trend, and so I'm just curious if there is an 8th trend which is like starting now, or that you sort of envision eventually becoming, you know, more relevant. So this is more like a general question. The economic question, maybe it's a little too technical, but something I notice is that if you look at the media, everybody talks about China, India, Russia, and Brazil as, you know, the growing economic powers in the world. But actually, if you look at some of the considered smaller countries, you know, Peru, Colombia, Chile, Latin America, Qatar, Israel, or Morocco, and you know, the Africa, Middle East, Indonesia, the Philippines in Asia. So, consider like a smaller country, they have GDP growth in the last 2 or 3 years of 6, 7, 8%, whereas, you know, Europe was crying and the United States were, oh my God, we have 0.75% growth. So, it's not really like the big four or five, but it's actually a mega trend in the world. And like, just the curiosity is whether, how is this perceived, how do you think this is perceived to sort of unbalance the economic equilibrium compared to, you know, the old regime of the United States, Germany, France, Japan?
Right.
You know, what's the general perception and what's going to become?
Right. Well, let me answer this first. Yes, absolutely, of course. All these countries are growing. You know, I cited Nigeria and Egypt in Africa, but of course the others you cited in Latin America. Is actually, this is making these countries, at least politically, bolder. They want to have a say at the table. I mean, what is happening in Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Egypt, they consider themselves regional powers. And they want to have a say, and they want to control, which is one of the reasons why, for example, Africa is very disunited in these days. This rhetoric of the African solidarity, I mean, it's a little bit of a rhetoric. Actually, countries don't really like each other that much. And I think this is due also to their economic boosting of their economy. Latin America, incredible proliferation of regional grouping, reshuffling. Of course, Chavez has a lot to do with it, also launching his own initiative from ALBA and other things. But these are also signs, I think, of countries that say, wait, the Organization of American States, which is basically something run by the United States, we're not playing that game anymore. We do our own regional organization, but multiple, because, of course, you know, they're all kind of growing at the same time, so it's very hard. So I think politically is rather destabilizing. I'm not predicting a war. I don't think that this would necessarily lead to violence. But it still would politically create a lot of uncertitude, and most of these countries will play on different tables. I think nowadays there are sort of two chess games, so the one on the table and the one under the table, right? And everybody's playing both at the same time. And you can see that in Middle East, you can see that in other regions. The eighth trend, well, I don't know. I mean, of course, I came out with seven because I thought seven was a nice number. I'm sure that all of you can come out with maybe some others. If I had to add an eighth one, it is what in some places of the world call a state fragility. It is very interesting what is happening to sovereignty in the world. Some countries which are recognized as countries, Somalia, Afghanistan, are barely able to actually control their territory. They're actually not really. Other countries were absolutely able to control their territory. Kosovo, Macedonia a few years ago had the problems they recognize. Part of Cyprus, South Sudan. They're all countries that are not recognized. Israel, of course, not being recognized by the Middle East, with a couple of exceptions. I always find very fascinating that, you know, we do accept certain countries as sovereign states that have zero control as sovereign states, while others, we do not accept them for different reasons, as countries, or for they would have the capacity. So the fragility of certain states, I think, is something that is growing, and it's worrisome. It's worrisome because, again, is the triple effect throughout the world. And we also know that what is happening in Somalia is an effect on us, not only piracy, but it's also terrorism, it's also destabilizing the East Africa area, which is, you know, a relevant place in the world. So that's I would add that trend.
It was interesting to learn when I was there that, in fact, there's a lot of Pakistani support for flood relief, but they just don't trust the government, which they see as a weak state.
Oh, absolutely.
So they give it through the causes of it and the political parties. And
absolutely. I mean, it's very hard for us, you know, when we say, you know, in Afghanistan, we bring democracy, which is a great concept. People has a high... They're very wary of their politicians. They do not trust their institutions. I do come from a country where most of the people, I mean, other Italians are here, don't really trust very much their own institutions. Italians have a tradition of actually being ruled. If you look at the history of Italy, it's been ruled by some groups that tend to exploit and leave, more or less. So there's a very different history that, for example, in the United States or in the UK, with this idea that is coming actually from the bottom up, right? In other places, it's always been perceived as something coming from the top. And so it's a very different perception, and it's bringing to this this illusion that we were talking about before.
I have a question about your point about the stars and how they attract attention.
About the stars. Yeah.
So George Clooney.
Yeah. I love George Clooney.
The first time when you said that, it was the first time that occurred to me the notion that perhaps this in itself causes a problem, because those very people that are now promoting aid and having spokespersons like Angelina Jolie and people who are very much attached to Western culture would also increase in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. Terrorism specifically pointed at aid agencies increasing. Mm-hmm. And if there was some, I'm just asking if there would be some parallel there.
I don't see it. I wouldn't make the connection. I think aid has been politicized well before George Clooney fought to, you know, get out of the movie and go into the real world. So I'm not surprised that aid agencies are targeted by rebels and terrorists and disenfranchised groups in general. It doesn't surprise me very much. The perception we have of George Clooney, of course, is very different than a Somali can have of George Clooney, right? The reason why George Clooney is attractive is not because he's attractive in Somalia. He's attractive because he can bring money from us into Somalia, right? So I wouldn't make that specific connection. I overall think it's a good thing. I think it's been able to, in the kind of culture and society we are, it's good that these people engage. And I have just to tell you one little thing. I've been... In a room last year where Bono and the Secretary General of the United Nations were giving a talk about development goals. I liked Bono very much. He came with a glass of gin tonic. Okay, he apologized, you know, I'm an artist. Okay? With sunglasses up here, it was night, of course. And he gave a talk with not a piece of paper in front of him. Was highly, highly thoughtful, very convincing, great advocate. I'm not going to say anything about the Secretary General of the United Nations, but was less convincing. So again, you know, I think these people can have a big role, and I'm actually glad that they do.
I have another question.
Yeah.
To monopolize the conversation. When we had filmed your colleague Ed Luck, he had explained that that unlike the way in the cultural sector that we think about change, which is that we want to be a witness to it, that we want to see it play out in our lives, that in fact that he thinks about change very differently. That he thinks that the United Nations Charter, for instance, is now playing out in the way that it was meant to 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And so he seemed to suggest that change needs to be understood on the level of decades or even centuries, and that perhaps that would be a different way of thinking about change than the way that in the cultural sector we all
do. True. No, but of course, he's citing my boss, who's this professor from Columbia University, so I cannot disagree. He's Edward Luck, who's an expert of the Security Council at the United Nations. I agree with him. Over time, over decades, UN has been changing. I mean, if you know something of the UN, maybe you know peacekeeping. Peacekeeping is not even part of the UN Charter. It's been invented and never been even included in the Charter of the United Nations. Okay? The structure of the UN has been changing dramatically over the years. So, yes, the institution has been changing over the decades. The problem is we don't have decades. That's what I was trying to say. I mean, things are moving way faster than that. We cannot wait the next 15 years in which we're going to find another way to meet within the Security Council so that everybody's happy. Because by that time, 9 billion people on the planet, density of people from, I think, 46 people per square kilometer up to 67 people per square kilometer. I mean, that is the big problem. And I don't really have a solution, because I do think that a world with the United Nations is a better world. I mean, I don't see the UN as the problem of the world, frankly. Right? I mean, the worst case scenario is irrelevant. So end of the story, right? At best, can do something, but that's fine. My problem is we need to have more rapid responses to these problems, and our institutional models are just not there. And I wonder if one day people will lose their patience and they will do something about it. And I don't know what this something could be.
Anti-institution. I mean, I think a lot in the way that people use technology and organized.
Yeah, I mean, there are two things we already mentioned. Technology and the sort of civil society, you know, kind of. I mean, first of all, societies tend to self-organize themselves much better than in the past, right? I mean, we're not only represented by political parties now. I mean, we're represented by, you know, other organizations. Maybe the real eighth trends was the death of ideologies. I mean, if you really think about what the 1900 was really about ideologies, today I don't see these macro ideologies out there. Technology, for sure, has been in some way democratizing the public discourse, but is also making, I think, things very easy to access, but also harder to really mobilize people. It's very easy to reply and to say I like on Facebook, but from there to actually do something about it, there is a big gap, right? So, you know, everybody has been saying how Twitter was being sort of mobilizer in Iran. This is actually not true. Most of the Twitters were tweeting in English, and as you know, that's not the language of the Iranian people. Iranian people were not organizing themselves through Twitter. They were organized through SMS. It's a lower level of technology, but still high technological. So technology has a lot to do, and is becoming more and more a substitute. And you see politicians, how they're struggling, because they have to deal with technology, right? And all the politicians that I know, they really have a hard time to deal with technology. All the older generation kind of reject technology. And it's a new language. It's hard. I mean, in some way we were born. Not really. I mean, not me. With all this technology. But some of the leadership have really hard time. And then, of course, when you go into developing countries, that's, the gap is even bigger. Most of the ambassador of the United Nations don't even have an email. Okay? And they're in New York.
They don't have what?
An email. They don't use email.
Ambassadors?
Uh-huh. African countries and Asian countries, etc. Very low technology. I'm not going to the level of technology in the UN because that's... way more could actually be done with technology to bring people back, if you want, in the circle. Technology can be used in a very positive way. I think that's absolutely. But again, very slow to adapt, right? I know it's a kind of a vicious circle, right? Because you are actually dealing with crisis every day. That's pretty much the mood in every kind of government. You have a crisis every day, so you don't really have time to think a sort of broad picture. That's why, for me, places actually like the United Nations, for example, they should be the place where they do this kind of thinking. They don't. They don't have the capacity. They should hire those kind of people. They should be able to attract, with attractive salaries, those kind of people. I think those kind of people, they're not going to the UN. They're going to banking, they're going to finance, they do venture capital, you know, they do those kind of things. And I think the government should try to attract these people back, because these are, you know, very important skills to have. And then again, I think there are, but this is very boring. I mean, there are details of reforms that can be done within the system, unifying departments, creating career paths that are cross. Right, so you don't just compartmentalize your life, but you're actually moving across topics and fields. There are ways to create things much more dynamic. I don't think it would take a lot of energy to do that. First, you have to think about it. A lot of things don't need a lot of consensus. It can actually be done within governments. But again, it's the inertia and this crisis mood. Also, another thing I think is very important to try to create, and that's part of my job actually, is to create space for politicians to get together in a real confidential way. There are no confidential spaces anymore. If you think about places like Davos, are big circles. They're public stages. People go there like they go on TV. You need to create off-the-record conversation. I'm not advocating secrecy here. I'm just advocating places where these people actually sit around the table and have thoughtful discussion about these kind of things. And there are very little opportunities now because everything has become part of the media show. And so there is actually a niche there of something that can be politically very useful.
So for those 50 conflicts that you were talking about that are going on right now.
Yeah. Well, it does happen, of course, at regional level, at local level, it always happens. As you know, conflict never interrupts communication, so a lot of time, peace and war, this will go in another topic, but peace and war happen at the same time. It's a substantive overlap between the two phenomena. So, you know, while a lot of Arab countries do not recognize Israel, they do deal with Israel every day, and they do business with Israel every day, and vice versa. Again, this is the double chess play. Okay, one on the table, one under the table. And so this conversation is happening very much. But you know, one of the problems that some of the governments have, and especially in the Middle East, is that some governments have to play a game for the streets. Because if the officials of Saudi Arabia say that they every day talk with the Israeli, they're going to have riots in the street. They cannot say that. Then of course, they have a dialogue all the time. Also on the most sensitive issues that you can ever think about, like nuclear, for example. But publicly, they have to play another game. They have to play another game because, I'm not kidding, they're going to have a riot in the street. So there is this big gap in, of perceptions that perception is very important. Maybe not true, but it's very important. The entire Arab region think that Iran is aiming to become a global, regional power. They call the Persian hegemony. Is that true? I don't know. But it is perceived in that way, and that make act in accordingly. So perception are extremely important in politics and in other things in life, of course. Thank you.